just essentially we're going to go through Perek Tzav on the basic elements, and look a little bit of Perek Chi, God willing, and get a sense of what's going on there.
Is this
Melachim Malach? Yes, One Kings. There's a few, I don't know if we have any English text. The truth is I should donate 5 or 6 Tanakhs to the shul, to this library. I always wonder whether somebody should put this library onto a, number the books to catalog it, because there's so much stuff here, even beautiful stuff.
I think it's been attempted?
And not succeeded, or is that the idea?
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
She has work at it to some extent, but I don't know.
But also there's no
work
what?
Doing.
I have even an English one, or even a Hebrew text. A Hebrew text. Is that a full Tanakh? It may not be a full one. Sometimes they start from Yeshayahu. Is that a good full one? Good. Okay. Anyway, we were speaking about Mashiach last time, just to give you a sense of where we're going to go over the next three sessions. This session we're going to finish chapter 5, God willing. Talk about the peace treaty they had with Tzur in the beginning of the building of the Beit HaMikdash. Next week we're going to talk about the Beit HaMikdash. I may limit that to one shiur, which is a lot of stuff to put into one shiur. But I don't want to spend time on every crevice and cranny of the Beit HaMikdash. We'll probably just highlight the larger issues. And then the week afterwards, we'll talk about the bracha that Shlomo gave to Bnei Israel right after.
Tefillah.
What's that?
And his tefillah.
His famous tefillah. His bracha and his tefillah. And then that would mean that we'll have to wait until we resume to get to the Queen of Sheba. So the excitement really doesn't begin completely, because building Beit HaMikdash, Queen of Sheba, so it's an easy win on the Queen of Sheba side, and we'll have to wait for that. Do you have a sefer? I'm going to need a .mikra a little, I guess, here. I have this one from the Farshim, so I may need it occasionally, but you could certainly use this for a while. Anyway, let's go to chapter 5, verse, let's see, the beginning we talked about his economy, the military economy, verse 9, which talks about his chachmah, because there's a little to mention there, and we sort of skipped over it, and I want to reference this, because I think it's rather important. Vayitein Elohim, chachmah l'shlomo, utvuna harbe ma'od, v'roch alev kachol asher al sfat hayam. So God gave to Shlomo Chachma and Bina. What's missing here is Dat, of course. What's missing here is Dat. The people build the who built the first temple, Bezalel. So he was given Chachma, Bina, and Dat. And the way that Chazal usually break that down, of course that's Chabad, but the way Chazal broke it down before Chabad started winning over the entire world. So the Chachma was essentially facts, Bina is the ability to process facts, and Dat is, what's that? Some kind of divinely inspired, the ability to perceive things based on divine help. It's not necessarily prophecy, although Bilam does say about himself, Hashomea Imre El Hamevin Dat something. So he compares his prophecy that he's getting, he does call that Dat a form of prophecy. What's that?
Creativity?
Yes, Thomas Aquinas deals with that actually a little bit, this idea of inspired knowledge. Sometimes I wonder whether Einstein could have done what Einstein did without, there's just some little thing that puts you over the top. Something that just sort of pushes you into a realm where nowhere else has gone before. Now, Shlomo doesn't get that. So are we to make something of the absence? I think the only thing that one might want to make of the absence of Dat here is the question of whether Shlomo was a prophet or not. And we dealt with those issues a little bit, and I think the general consensus is that Shlomo was not a prophet. Even though he had those two dreams, the Rambam is very careful to point out that it says he woke up, v'hinei chalom, it was a dream. And the Rambam says in Moreh Nevuchim that if you recognize that it's a dream, it's not a prophecy. Maybe inspired, maybe Ruach HaKodesh, but it's not a prophecy. A prophet is unaware of the fact that he is dreaming. He's completely unaware of the fact that he's dreaming. So maybe that's something that could be learned out of the pasuk, but it's hard to say. I'm certainly under the opinion that Shlomo was not a prophet. Next verse, 10. Vatayrim chokhmat Shlomo mechokhmat kol b'nei kedem mikol chokhmat Mitzrayim. His knowledge multiplied or was greater than all the knowledge of the West and all the knowledge of the East. And of course, when you talk about the West and East here, the West we're talking about Mesopotamia. Sumerian and Babylonian and Assyrian lore, and on the east side you have Egyptian lore. So essentially that's the original.
I think that's reversed.
Oh, sorry, thank you. Thank you. East being Mesopotamia, thank you, west being Egyptian. And that's something that we spoke about a few times ago, the idea of Greater Israel as opposed to Lesser Israel. Lesser Israel being the habitable borders of Israel, but Greater Israel being this idea of spreading out knowledge and the faith of Judaism. Now this is going to get important when it comes to Messianism. I'm going to have to finish up Messianism with this idea, so I'll get to it shortly. Yes, but the question is, which one did God mean? The question is, was God kidding one time and not kidding another time, or was he joking the first time and not the second time? And it doesn't only show up once, it shows up a few times. The way that Rabbi Yoel ben Nun explains it, and I think it's probably the best explanation, is Lesser Israel was meant for habitation. That is, this is where Jews would, you know, ostensibly live. But Greater Israel was the idea that this is where I want the presence of Jewish thought, monotheism, to spread out to. That is, its goal was to spread out completely to the borders of the of the entire what's called the Levant, Syria, Lebanon, and Israel, and touch upon the borders of Mesopotamia and Egypt for reasons which we're going to see shortly. So that's the way he explains it. He doesn't explain it as two different conflicting prophecies, but two complementary prophecies, one being more spiritual, religious, and one being practically, you know, where you're going to live. Chokhmah seems to be factual knowledge. Chokhmah seems to be fact, the ability to store factual knowledge. Yeah, it's possible. I mean, all these words are a little hard to... Yeah, I agree. I would have thought wisdom is more of Bina. Bina tends to be more of a wisdom idea, the ability to put A and B together and wind up with something brand new. And I think that requires some wisdom. On the other hand, you could say wisdom is really not so much... we're playing games here, because we're playing semantics both in Hebrew as well as in English. I'm not sure what wisdom means. I'm not sure it means the same thing for everybody. However, if we think of wisdom as not an accumulation of facts, but accumulation of life experience, then we could still put that under the chokhmah increasing facts. The facts just happen not to be book facts, but they're life experience facts. What's that?
Street
a street smart. There's certain, you know, when as we grow older, based on all the mistakes that we've made, it matters not to pay for them too dearly. So we grow a little bit wiser, and that I think would be an accumulation of facts as well. That fits nicely under chokhmah rather than bina. Bina seems to be the ability to really create, you know, to observe something and be able to deduce a new property from it. Perhaps what they call indirect proofs in geometry, you know, to really be able to drop a new line and figure out how to calculate the shape of a non-right triangle.
But cannot try to depict children's lives, like for the case where you have the two women who both claim child.
Right, right.
So that was their way of showing how nice.
Correct, absolutely. Or maybe just how well he knew people. The question is that factual, is that, and maybe all things together. It's hard to really, again, you know, these words are so imprecise that it's hard to take a single word and just sum it up. Be sort of me like saying we have peace now. You know, it's just there's no way to take any single word and try to apply it to a whole set of a very broad set of information, and it's hard to do. But I think that's the general breakdown. Now, in verse 11, the Yechkam Mikol Hadam Meitan Ezrachi Veiman V'Chakol V'Dadav Dei Machol Vayishmo B'Chol Hagoyim Saviv. Now the first parts I explained, I think we've actually done this, so I don't want to do it again, but I think there was a sense of a criticism here that he's not paying attention to his prophets, but I'm not going to go into that again. But afterwards, Vayishmo B'Chol Hagoyim Saviv, so the word got out to all the other nations. And people who were here last week probably know where I'm going with this, but you'll shortly see what I mean. Vayidaber Shloshet Alafei Mashal. He spoke 3,000 mashals. I'm not going to translate that just yet. But he shiro in his poetry, but was chamisha va'alef, was 1,005, which is sort of a strange number, right? Exactly 1,005. Why not 1,010? Why not round down to 1,000? It's very little strange. Vayidaber al etzim min ha'arez ashel b'levanon v'adezov asher yotzei v'kir vayidaber al behima v'al ha'ofi al ha'remes v'adagim v'yavo b'kol ha'amin v'shmo et chokhmat shalom v'eit malchei ha'aretz. I'm going to go pasuk. So first one is let's talk about the mashals. A mashal is many things. In fact, mashal has also been used for the word prophecy. Vayisam mishalo vayomar in the case of Bilam, and also the case of Yishayahu. But a mashal generally means being able to say a lot in very few words. That's really what a mashal is. A mashal can mean I'm metaphorizing, I'm a simile, I'm doing a simile. A simile is A is like B. In a metaphor, I never even mention A. You're supposed to figure out A from B. There are various ways that I can get about making my point. And the fact that I'm able to sum up a tremendous amount of knowledge in a very few words, which makes me a powerful educator. That's the trick about mashals. Mashals were clever mnemonic devices to tell you a lot of powerful information in as few words as possible. And that's the key to a mashal. What's that? Oh, so right. So if you had to, so what that means is he had a real school going. Shloshet Alfim. So here's something very interesting. So I can tell you that what Chazal do with this, and I'm sorry, what Rashi and the Reed Tara do with this, Rashi's friend and student. Alafim could also mean teachings, not from Alafim, but like Olpan, from the word Olpan, Olpanim, Olpanot. So the problem is that these 3,000 don't match into what we know of Shlomo's works. That is, we have Kohelet, we have Shir Shir, and we have Mishlei. Now, there's a lot of Mishalim and Mishlei, you should know. Some of Mishlei, like for instance the last chapter, Eshechayel Nintzel, let's assume that that was written by Shlomo, because the text actually says it wasn't. The text said it was written by some person that we don't know, and it may or may not have been Shlomo. But Eshechayel Nintzel is a single Mashal. However, if you open up Mishlei, you'll find Mashalim, which are one sentence long. I mean, really, one sentence. And the next line is completely unrelated to the previous one. Sometimes they're only connected because they share a single word, but not necessarily idea. Very often you have chapters in Mishlei which are couplets. So I have two ideas, two psukim which relate to each other, and now I'm on new topic. So by the way, if you ever come upon Mishlei and you're looking for contiguity, you're looking for a continuous thought, and you're thinking, you know, why am I not smart enough to understand this? The answer is you're approaching it all wrong. You are smart enough to understand it. You're looking for something that doesn't exist. But even if we were to assume that that was true, we would not be able to come up with the number 3,000 plus. You just couldn't do that. So what Rashi the Rikara wants to do here is they want to explain that it's not Shloshet Alfim 3,000, but Shloshet Olpanim, three teachings, i.e. Kohelet, Mishlei, and Shir HaShirim. Now, what that assumes, by the way, is that everything, now this is a very important idea, by the way, you have to understand there's a real polemic here. There's a real argument here. It's a question on the very canonization. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the canonization of our Bible. And the question is, did we get everything? You follow? Does our Bible have everything in it that was said? I can tell you that at Qumran, if you open up the famous, what's called the 11Q Psalter, which is a psalm book, which has the famous, it has Ashrei, the famous Ashrei, Tehillat David, done antiphonally. It has like Kiliom Lom Chasdo in every pasuk. So they would say, Aramim Chaloy Amalech, Vachashim Chaloy Lom Va'ed, and everybody else would say Kiliom Lom Chasdo. And they would say, V'cholyom Avachecha. So that's why most scholars today think that it wasn't a book of Tehillim, but it was actually a Siddur. It's actually a Siddur. But at the very beginning of the Siddur, it says, and David wrote 1,500 Tehillot. And explaining that he wrote some for this day and some for that day, and the number comes up to at least 1,500. It actually, the actual number skips over my head. A massive amount, which means according to the sect of Qumran, they felt that we received 150, plus maybe a few, there were a few extras that we also have there, but that there were 1,000 more, which simply never came down to us. In addition, if you take a look in Chronicles, in the book of Divrei Yamim, there are things like, V'hine Katuv B'Sefer Ido. Who's that? Never met a Sefer Ido. I know Treyazar is hard to memorize, so it's hard to remember exactly who's in Treyazar, but I guarantee you there's no Ido in Treyazar.
But there is in Malachi.
What's that?
There is in Malachi.
There are people, the question was, is he the guy who died or something? I think he was the one who may have died or gone to. I don't think he's mentioned by name.
He was a prophet. He was a
Nazi. Malachim?
Yeah, I think he chastised...
Achav?
No. Yerovam.
Yeah, that's the nameless. We don't know the name of him. And then he dies on the way back because he wasn't... Never. But he, Ish Navi Meyuda. We never find out who he is. Chazal say he was Edo. Based on the idea, by the way, of conservation of biblical characters. By the way, that happens not only biblical characters, but scholarship everywhere. I have a certain amount of names. I have a piece of writing that I don't know who it is. Or I have a David here, I got a David there, must be the same, well, in the case of David, we know who it is, but different people, you know, there might have been two Edos, there might have been two Asafs, there might have been, you know, there's always the idea of the conservation of characters in Tanakh. Chazal always trying to look for a match, and not only everywhere, this is simply, you know, you know who you know, so you come across a name, you don't believe that it's somebody you never heard of, you like to believe that he wrote more than one thing. Chazal deal with the Edo problem. How did they deal with the Edo problem? Edo wrote a book of prophecy which was not needed for all generations. It was needed only for a single generation. Chazal say that the only prophecy which we came down to us in our books of Tanakh, the only ones that were canonized in our books of Tanakh, are ones that were needed for all generations. However, by that, Chazal are saying everything that was needed for all generations is in Tanakh. You see, it's a double-edged sword. On
well,
one hand,
that was written,
everything
that was given before.
Everything that was prophesied, which either prophet or the god or whoever's making decisions knew would be required for the generations, received Tanakh. There was no book which was lost. It wasn't that there were originally 25 books of the Bible rather than 24, and that we lost one, somebody dropped it and we forgot all about it. There were originally 24, and this was all the prophecy that was ever said regarding all generations. Not the all the prophecy that was ever said. We know that's not true. But all the prophecy that was ever said that was meant for eternity, that was in our Tanakh, and not there was not another thing said that didn't come down to us, which is a high degree of faith. There's a reason why they're saying this. There's a reason why we'd like to believe this, because if there's some other piece of prophecy that we don't know about that we really need, we're in big trouble, you know? We'd like to believe that every possible scenario that we might need a prophet to help us out with is covered in Tanakh, okay? I'm not disparaging this idea that you should know something. In the Qumran caves, which I mentioned, not only do they have specifically our Tehillim, most of them, 143, but the first 100 or so are in the order that we have them, in the order that we have them, which is significant because the order that we have them is not necessarily sensical. You could also drive yourself crazy looking through Tehillim trying to find an order. Now, there are groupings that make sense, but a sequence of ideas pops around a lot to the point where Ibn Ezra said, don't look for an order. It's not an order. But even though there is no order, that order, which is no order, was already extant in the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That gives a thumbs up to the idea that the canon is very old. It's very old. And the older it is, the more likely it is to be the complete set of works, rather than just the abridged best of Agatha Christie things that you buy in leather. And, you know, it doesn't include some of the stuff that people don't like so much. However, the truth is, it's really, I'm not sure why, getting back to the original point, that took a long detour, so let me get back to Shlomo. I'm not sure why Rashi, and I think even the Rikara and maybe others before him, tried to force this pasuk into meaning that these were the three books that he wrote. It could be the Mishalim that we have are the ones that somebody decided that these were the ones that were required for eternity. And there was a whole bunch of other ones that were not required. They were nice muscles. Like, I don't know, don't walk through traffic on a busy day. Don't stick a finger, don't stick a screwdriver into an electrical socket. They're nice. What? So, on one hand, they seem nice. On the other hand,
Shlomo,
you know...
Didn't say that.
What's that?
Shlomo didn't say that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think he said that.
Right. But, I mean, you can imagine, what were the famous things? There's always, there's a few off-color ones that people say, you know, about not eating in certain places, and... You know, there's various mashalim that people tell that, are not entirely, you know, they're not inspired. They're not absolutely necessary. And therefore, they weren't written down. So I'm not entirely sure this. Shlomo is making a school, an education school. And as I've mentioned in this here in this class before, there were three known schools. We know this from Yechezkel, we know this from Yirmiyahu, but most people forget about it. There was the prophetic school, Harotzed Davar Yelecho Navi, Harotzed Torah Yelecho Kohen. Somebody who wants instruction about Tuma and Tara, Kashas, Nakash, will go to a Kohen. Somebody wants good advice. These were a tripartite division, which, by the way, Rabbi Dr. Lyman says is equal to our Tanakh. That is, Torah would be taught like Torah Kohanim, what you have to do. Nevi'im would be the word of God and how to deal with things. And wisdom and knowing how to behave in a wise way would be Ketuvim. But this was a well-known school. And this school is something which Shlomo was apparently the head of, a master of. And you should know something. We've dug up Akkadian tablets from Mesopotamia with school systems on them. Tablets with hundreds of math problems. And they're not easy math problems. They weren't dummies. They didn't know calculus, but they knew their algebra. What happens if you have 40 pieces of barley and somebody takes 25% of them and somebody raises the price by 35% and then... difficult problems, like those things where train A is leaving from one place at one time and train B, you know, don't you hate those? You should try them in Akkadian. You know, they're really difficult in Akkadian. and really difficult psalms, hundreds of them, one after the other. And they were trained over and over to memorize these things.
What
the idea
of
these... What's that? They didn't have zero. They didn't have zero, but they knew how to count above that, into the thousands, into the hundreds of thousands.
Right, but there's a difference. It's harder to do math with the Roman numerals than with...
Oh, they had... it was more like spelling, like 17 would be spelled out. It's as if you could only write 17, S-E-V-E-N-T-E-E-N.
Oh.
So it was incredibly difficult math
there.
System. You couldn't... There was no borrowing, carrying, multiplication, division, nothing like that. You had to memorize your math. If you didn't know your math tables, it wasn't like you didn't get to fourth grade. They would not let you go to fourth grade. You know, it was worse than the New York system where they'd hold kids back. You weren't going anywhere. And everybody wanted to be a scribe, by the way, because this was this famous scribal school. Because if you were a scribal school, you didn't wind up, you know, you lived a nice long life. Your hands were clean all the time. You were in the presence of the king in the palace. You very often went on important missions. You didn't work in the fields and you didn't become a slave. So being a scribe, let me tell you something, you know, you tried not to fail out of those systems. But these tablets, these education tablets, they're incredibly long. We have lists of God's names, thousands of them. And they would apparently have to memorize them, you know, one after the other. They'd have to know them, each one, what each one was responsible for, and when you'd have to pray to each one, and when you'd have to have the good day to sacrifice to one, and the bad day to sacrifice. Humongous amount of knowledge material. So this really shouldn't surprise you, this 3,000. And also, it doesn't you know, the fact that we only have a piece of Shlomo's Mishalim just means that somebody, either God told Shlomo which ones, or inspired Shlomo to tell him which ones are the best ones. Our Mishalim are the best of, you could say. Our Sefer Mishlei is the best of Shlomo. And I think that's perfectly a valid way to go about it. The next piece, by the way, is the fact that Shlomo talks to trees. I want to clarify this. Shlomo does not talk to trees.
They talk
about trees. That's correct. That's an important idea. Of course, in the Gemara, plays up the whole idea where he could actually talk to animals and talk to... These are metaphors. These are metaphors. These are beautiful. Now, I don't know whether Shlomo could talk to animals or not. I don't think so. All I know for sure is this pasuk does not say that. And that's where most people really rely on this pasuk. I want to read the pasuk again. Vayidaber, verse 13, Vayidaber al ha'itzim. Mina eres ashel banon ha'ba'arezo. If you talk about the trees, from the great cedar trees until the za'atar, little za'atar bushes that come out of the wall. By the way, whoever did that was very nice. That artwork. That was,
yeah.
That's the, I walked
yeah,
in. What? Well, that was, it was beautiful.
Yeah, Sasha Roth and Jamie Thomas.
Oh, no, that makes sense. It was just you get a beautiful feeling. It was very nice. If you go into that, if you go there, what they did is they put lines on it. Made it look like a hotel, and they actually put the little zatar bushes, the little azoves coming out of the wall.
Initially, I complained. I said, no bushes.
Oh, I see. The zatar came later? Very nice, very nice. Now, this is, so what were, the simple read of this pasuk, the wrong read of this pasuk would say he spoke to trees and spoke to animals. That's the wrong read. And he spoke to, let's continue to see what he spoke about. The cedar to the za'atar bush, to the bush that comes out, you know, like those little bushes that come out of the kotel wall. That's what they're talking about, more or less. Vayidaber al ha-behema va'al-ha'of. He spoke al ha-behema va'al-ha'of. Now watch, there's not two vavs there. It's al ha-behema va'al-ha'of, which means really from the beast to the birds. From the beast to the birds. Ve'al ha-remes. The Allah Dagim. And on the, well, I'm not sure, actually, maybe four separate categories, actually. It could be, you know what, I'm not sure. Maybe it's four categories. It would be beasts, birds, remes would be creepy crawlies, and Dagim would be fish. Curious, by the way, that Dagim come after Sheretz, but that probably follows the idea of voracious a little bit. What's that? What's on this specific? Yeah, correct. Maybe Dagim first, but it could be Sheretz came before Dagim. I have to look it up in Bereishit. But it's not clear to me, when I'm looking at these Pesukim, it's not entirely clear to me why the order is the way it is. It's a little bit weird, but Behema and Oph, I understand, and then Remesh and Dagim, I would have thought, if I was going from like bigger to small, if I was going from like superior animal to inferior animal, I would have started with Behema and wound up with Remesh. But maybe there's And then Remesh... so that's a possibility. Right. And Remes, by the way, if you translate Remes as amphibian, you're not too far off. That is a sea creature that comes out and kind of spewns onto the land. That's not a bad translation of it. So actually, that thank you. That does actually make it a little more clear. I was having a problem with the order.
Right.
A man is like a tree. Very possibly. I believe we may also give him credit for something else. I believe we may give him credit for zoology and botany. I think that's the way that psukim are usually read. What you're saying may also be true. And it could be that one requires the knowledge of the other. Before I can metaphorize something, I need to be able to master of that thing that I'm metaphorizing. But the truth is, I think he may have had the technion, or the university of choice was probably in Shlomo's house. That was probably where people came to study the mastery of the world around them, the natural world around them. That would be the simple read of the psukim. Your metaphor idea is an interesting idea, and I hadn't thought of it before. However, I believe there's another piece which may be even more true, and that gets us to our messianic idea. The Azov and the cedar tree have a powerful image, because the cedar tree was the mightiest of trees known at that time. I didn't know about California redwoods. Cedar tree grows to about 150 feet, and it doesn't easily break. It smells nice. It's a beautiful tree. You build nice buildings at it. And keep in mind that when you're building a big building and you don't know about the arch, which they did not know about then, your tallest building was as big as your tallest tree. So the bigger the tree, the better your manufacturing. The cedar tree was a much desired tree. And a zove grows in nothing. It doesn't even need a tree. You give it a little dirt and a rock, and it grows in there. And what's interesting, though, is it's also, here's another opposite. One is an eighth srach. It's a tree that can only be looked at, not and used, but not eaten from. But an azov is spice. Azov is a za'atar. We use it today. Go to Israel, you put a little za'atar on your hummus and whatnot, and you've got yourself a great little meal.
The
za'atar
makes a tea with it.
What's that, does it? Oh, very nice. There is.
When you burn off the paraduma, yeah. You require these two items.
Yes, right. The azov, and that's sarat also. Sarat, you also require these two things. That's right. In the idea of Tuma and Tahara, the cedar and the azov are the two significant things that are brought in as part of the whole purification process, which makes me believe, and there's no way to know for sure, but I believe, and I think that I'm not the first one to say this, by the way, by no means, that Shlomo may not just be talking about zoology and botany, but he may. And he's not just telling beautiful things, he's teaching Torah. He's teaching Torah. If you look, when I look at the words behema, remes, dog, and sheret, I tell you what comes into my mind is Sefer Bereishit. He's teaching, the philosophy, creationism, how God creates the world. And when he talks about the cedar and when he talks about the Arzeh Levanon and he talks about the Erez and the Azov, he's not just talking about Bani, but he's talking about the idea of Tum and Tara. He's teaching Tum and Tara, which means he had the Kohanim business nice and locked up also.
Also, the poor
That's an interesting idea. That's possible as well. And here's where we get back to the messianic idea, because what we spoke about here, I see actually not too many people that were here last week or here this week. Last week we spoke about the idea that the Messiah may have come. Shlomo may have been the Messiah. We saw a pasuk that certainly seems to indicate that messianic times had begun. What was the problem? So we read in the pink book that nice translation there, that the reason why Mashiach didn't come is because one of the requirements of Mashiach is that the rest of the world comes to you, to hear all the world comes to Yerushalayim to hear the word of God. But if Shlomo is teaching Torah here, let's take a look at the Pesukim, what the Pesukim say. Let's go to Pasuk 14. V'yavo mikol ha'amim, and all of the nations, l'shmor chokhmat Shlomo, the wisdom of Shlomo, which may be the Torah of Shlomo, Me'ekol malchei ha'aretz, all the kings sent their advisors, the kings themselves sent their wise men, asher shamu et chokhmato. Anybody who heard Shlomo's chokhmah ran to Yerushalayim to hear about it. So our last little, last week we tried to show the fact that the nations did not follow Eretz Yisrael, Bnei Yisrael, was an indication that Mashiach had not come. But I have to tell you, the nations are following Eretz Yisrael at this point. Now things may go south in 20 years from now, we'll see. But at this point, I will reiterate what I said last time, and I can't, I realize that for everybody who wasn't here last time, so I'm going to say something, you're like, no way. But I'm just going to say that, in my opinion, Mashiach is here now, in this page, in this pasuk. Huh. Mashiach had arrived.
Yeah.
No, well, that may be true. I'm from Shevet Levi, so it's not me. It certainly may be somebody. So we can eliminate the Levium. But otherwise, unless we're Chashmonai, in which case we have delusions of grandeur. But it may be in this room. But I'm saying in this pasuk, Mashiach exists. Here again, I refer to what's referred to as the what's called the restorative Mashiach, which means not some utopian supernatural view of Mashiach, but an idea that all the Jews live in safety and comfort and peace and happiness. Wisdom flows out of Eretz Yisrael, and all the people from all the nations come to Eretz Yisrael via the wisdom. That's the definition of Mashiach minus Tchiyat HaMetim, which according to the Rambam doesn't happen until many, many years after Mashiach is already around. So I would like to argue that we're looking at Mashiach, which would unfortunately was in Shlomo's grasp and then slipped through his fingers.
Noah
also the
Rambam.
Yeah, I think that is a messianic. I think that is a hint at messianism there in Noah's pasuk. I think you're right. And of course, the bigger proof we brought was from Yishayah, the famous Yishayah and Micha, and all believe in Haru Elav Kol Ha'amim VaYevo Yushalayim VeYisa Migvaot. It's the one we say on. When do we say that? VeYisa Migvaot VeNaru Kol Mitzrayim BaYomahu. It's a famous haftarah about the messianic times. Right. It could be, and that would be more of a utopian view of messianism. There's what's called a restorative view of messianism, which means this ideal equals Mashiach. It's not a preparation of Mashiach, but it's actually Mashiach now. And it's a dialectic that exists not only in between the Rambam and the Ramchal, and between the Gemara, I think it was Rav Shimon and somebody else, about whether everything's going to change Mashiach's time or nothing's going to change Mashiach's time. But it goes back even to prophets, where certain prophets take more of one view and certain prophets take more of another view. But that's I just wanted to point that out here. Essentially, what you have is pretty much utopia from a spiritual sense. And I believe that's what these Pesukim are talking about. I don't think they're just talking about botany. I think what he's saying is he's teaching people essentially everything you have to know about spirituality and Torah as well, and people are coming to listen to him. It's all merged together, science, Torah, it's all come and merged together in Shlomo's time. Anyway, let's continue on. And we're going to get to, how are we doing? It's 9:07, so I should have enough time for this. This is the famous Treaty of Tzur. So we'll read the Pesukim, and then I'll explain the framework and the geography and the geopolitics of what's going on here. Vayishlach Hiram Melech Tzur, Hiram, who was the king of Tzur, sent a letter in the hands of his servant. El Shlomo, ki shama ki oto mashkul melech tachar avihu, kohev ayach Hiram tavi koimen. Now we've met Hiram before. Hiram was a partner with Davin HaMelech. They liked each other very much. Yes, Hiram, in fact, is a name. We dug up a lot of material from Phoenicia, because that's where this is, and I'll explain. I have a little map here, so I'll show where it is. Hiram is a very popular name. It shows up over and over and over again. Like in Syria, you have the name Hadad, or Ben-Hadad. Shows up over and over again. And Pharaoh is more of a job, but the names like Ramses, you had Ramses the first, second, third, and then Ramses the third wasn't related to Ramses the second. He took the name, the one with the 19th dynasty, and one with the 20th dynasty, they took the name because they wanted to pretend that they were continuing. Antiochus would be a good example.
Did they take the
What's that? Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. What? Yeah, exactly right. Yes, because you want to kind of reestablish a certain historical connection. This is true about Hor. However, this Hor is the one who made a treaty with David, because he'll say so. I was friends with David all your life. So in this particular case, this is the same Hor, although you do have to be careful when you read about this Hiram. In fact, we're going to meet another Hiram coming up that most people are surprised about. In fact, if you want me to show it to you now, it's very interesting. Don't lose your place, but we take a look at the building of the Beit HaMikdash. So I said I wasn't going to talk about the building of the Beit HaMikdash, but I guess I lied.
He was like an architect.
He was the architect. Where is he? I know where to find him in Divrei Hayamim. Oh, here it is. Take a look in chapter 7, verse 13.
Was he from Naphtali or something?
Chapter 7, verse 13.
One?
What?
Yeah.
Is it a different one?
Jew. Yeah, you'll see what it is.
Exactly the same.
Well, but wait. You'll see something very interesting. Right, can't be the same one because Shlomo's not going, getting, you know, he's not going to get a king to start building his Beit HaMikdash. But it's very interesting. I'm going to show you, it's actually a little bit of a, it's not a criticism, it's something that we have to be aware of was going on after this peace treaty. We're skipping over the peace treaty. So imagine now that the peace treaty is made between Shlomo and Tzur, and I'll explain what that is soon. Vayishlach HaMelech Shlomo Vayikach Et Hiram Mitzur. Who is he? Ben Isha Almanahu. He was the son of a widow, Mimate Naphtali, from the tribe of Naphtali, Va'aviv Ish Tzori, Choresh Nechoshet. His father was a Tzorite. That means, I'm not sure he was Jewish. He's Venetian. You follow? Now, I'm not sure if that's his stepdad. I don't know. It's not quite clear. But what you have here is the two tribes are intermingling together because of the peace treaty. Keep in mind that they're both Semitic. The Phoenicians are Semitic. We are Semitic. And this guy was named after, he was a Jewish kid. His mother was Jewish. But he's named after the king of Tzur. That's so, it's like, I don't know, if I named my son George W. Levy, you know, and it happens, you know, people do that. But it's, and that doesn't indicate that there's syncretism on a religious level. It doesn't mean that people are giving up their Judaism. But on a social, political level, what you're looking at is a merger of two countries. Now we'll go back to the beginning of the merger, but I want to show you that pasuk to show you how strong the merger eventually becomes, that they start naming Jewish kids after the king of Tzur, and that there's a certain amount of, I don't want to say exactly intermarriage, because, you know, the words conversion and intermarriage are more meaningful today than they were back then, because, you know, back then you married a guy, you were whatever the guy was, essentially. That's the way it works. If you're a woman, you took on the nature of your father's household. That was just the way it was. It was like you went to, you know, three rabbis and you know, converted to Judaism. I realize that we have our sense of conversion from roots. But, you know, people always wonder, who did Yaakov's children marry if they were all not Jewish? So the other answer is that they converted. And the truth is that's true, but only in the loosest of senses. It means as soon as they married them, they were what they were. And in fact, Esav is not told to marry nobody. Esav is told only not to marry who? A Kanani. He's not allowed to marry a Kanani. That's unacceptable from Shemecham. He's never, if he would have picked up a nice Edomite, who was from Avraham, or a nice Moabite, or a nice, a Phoenician girl. Well, that's correct. Yeah, that's right. So, what's that? Right, by Yisrael, correct. So what you're seeing there is the prohibition is more racial than religious, to be perfectly honest, because religion didn't, it just wasn't an issue back then. It wasn't like, you know, you were what your husband was. You took upon, you know, like today we still have a shadow of that when a Jewish woman, when she marries a Jewish guy, so she takes on his menagim. You know, that's in circles, like if she doesn't hold kidney out and he does, and maybe they play around a little bit, but by a general rule, she's going to take on his menhagim because that's really the way it worked. But back in the olden days, she took everything that, you know, she was him.
Did she have to convert?
I imagine that there was probably some kind of pro forma conversion. There was no doubt in mikvah. She would probably have to, you know, dip in a mikvah. But she didn't have to go and study up on being Jewish and make a commitment to it and stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
And of course, we're very upset today when the Rambam talks about it. The Rambam says that when a woman converts out of marriage or a man converts out of marriage, we can't. The Rambam says this explicitly. He talks about the difference between a ger tzedek and a stam ger. So stam ger does it for sort of the wrong reasons, but we don't push them away. So says the Rambam. But so today they're very uncomfortable with somebody who decides to convert for marriage reasons. What's that? Real, are they?
Yes.
In what sense?
When they came to the U.S., I don't know if it's true or not,
up in all the Syrian shuls, they have a declaration by all the Syrian rabbis.
Which
saying they only accept
converts.
Of any kind.
Syrian converts,
yeah. My daughter Esther was at a bris in a Svartic shul in Brooklyn somewhere. And it was somebody whose child, the person that had the child was someone she worked with, and she said she went there, all the people from work went, and they were all married to Goyim, you know, or converts or whatever, and all over, she said, there were signs all over the shul about that, we accept no converts.
Wow.
But look at the community, they have a whole lot less people married.
Do they?
I guess I. Yeah, I guess.
Syrian?
Well, it's a very tight community, although it's probably less tight in deal than it was in, you know, in Syria.
In Aleppo.
In Aleppo, right. I don't know, this you know, that's
ironic, I guess, times have changed, because the Rambam, obviously, I think the Rambam's reflecting what you were saying, that in the olden days, it was just much more normal, the women would take on all the customs of their husband automatically.
Right, well, that was actually, that was even more evolved. I think Rambam was just aware of the fact that the situation, what the situation was, and we can't do anything about it. But in biblical times, a conversion, no doubt, was done, but it wasn't like something you had, you didn't have to study up for 3 years and pass the test and, you know, and be accepted by the community.
But
you were what your husband was.
Yeah, but
what's
then?
That? I went to Tevila. There was a circumcision probably for the man, but, well, no, that wouldn't work the other way. I guess for a man who converted, you have to go through the whole thing, but a woman who converted, go through Tevila, marry in, and end of story. Now, there's criticism there. There's even back in time, Ezra criticized her not to marry these girls. What's the big deal about marrying those girls if they're what you are anyway? Because, of course, they're what you are, but they're still what they are, and it affects, you know, it affects what's going on. That is, I could say that even in the ancient times, when a non-Jewish girl married into the Jewish people, she sort of became automatically Jewish. But one can't deny, as Ezra can't deny, that she's bringing her TV set with her, so to speak. What?
Well,
yeah, exactly. We're going to get to exactly that point. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Absolutely correct. Although Shlomi could argue, you know, had a head there because he was doing it for political reasons. But you're right. On the same. What's that? Well, women, you know what women will do to that whole wisdom thing. I think that's the first thing in Mishlei. If I'm not mistaken, that's like the first line in Mishlei. Mishlei opens up with what kind of woman, and it ends with what kind of woman. To tell you that if you really want to be wise, so it really depends on the kind of woman that you associate with. So there's a piece of blinding his eyes. Yeah, we'll get to the fall of. It's going to take us a while, but it'll probably take us another, you know, 2 months of another 8 classes. But we'll get to, maybe a little less, but we'll get to the fall of Shlomo. It's actually pretty sad. There was one particular woman that did it to him, actually. It was the good old Queen of Sheba, the Queen of Sheba, really corrupts him, and we'll look at that. It doesn't even look like that text. It's, oh, she's wonderful, she comes, you're wonderful, fantastic. But there's an incredibly corrupting force there, which I'll show you. And she causes all kinds of problems that most people are not aware of, and we'll get back to her in a little bit. Anyway, let's talk about the beginning of this treaty, since we talked about the end of the treaty, or the consequence of the treaty. Verse 15.
Verse what?
15, 1-5. Yeah. In chapter, back chapter 5. And I'm going to try to skim through this a little faster so we can get through, hopefully, the whole section, but I may not be able to do it. Vayisachi Ram Melech Tzur El Avadav V'Shlomo, so he sends a letter, verse 16.
Oh, you didn't say a letter. What?
The reason why, I'm sorry, it doesn't say a letter. Yeah. In my mind, I just happen to know that whenever they went with these cuneiform tablets, and on the tablets was chiseled down. It wasn't done by memory. It was always done by a letter. I have some pictures of them at home, and they're beautiful to see, but yeah, I apologize. He just sent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he sent his servant. Takaravi, or so he, because he had peace treaty. Vayishlach Shlomo El Hiram Lemor. He says, listen. That's an incredibly important word. My father, by the way, this is not the whole, remember, David couldn't build it because he had blood all over his hands. Right? That's what everybody knows because that's what it says in Divrei Yamim. But here he doesn't say that at all. He says the reason why David wasn't able to build the temple is because he had war. He didn't have time. There is a similarity, but it's not just that because he killed. People think because David was like a killer. It can't be that. You know why? The first thing Shlomo did when he got into business, he offed his brother, he offed his general. He had a whole bunch of people off.
He took care of some of the people that brought the war.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. So you can say he had more blood on his hands.
He had other people do it.
I mean, he knew how to have other people.
Do we know that David actually murdered? You know, I don't think David.
What?
Yeah, it was a war. Ah, but the question is, was Shlomo a warrior? So here's a good question. Take a look at what this says. This says he couldn't build it because he had too much war around him. Ad teit Hashem otam, until God gave over these enemies, tachat kabot raglai, under the feet of my feet, which means who won the wars in the end? Who was fighting the wars? Shlomo. Now, we don't know that Shlomo went to war, and there may be reason to believe, I'm not going to go into right now, there may be good textual reason to believe that he was an armchair general, not a full general.
Here it says David's feet.
Oh, very interesting. So what we have here is a Kriya Ketiv. Does anybody see that?
Yeah.
The Ketiv is raglav.
Yeah.
under
yes.
his feet,
mm.
but the Kri is Raglai, my feet, and now you got a real problem. And I have to tell you, the difference between, the question is, where, now we could spend an hour, at least, on the question of what's with those Kri thieves. Now, some Kri thieves, we know exactly what it is. For instance, the Tochacha coming up, no, it's the one coming up in Bamidbar. It says, Vehem yishagena im nashechem. They're going to sleep with your wives. Nishagelna was such a vicious, nasty word, you know, that they, it was a, like a bad slang, so they changed it for tishgatna. Take a look there. There's a the Kri is tishagelna, and the Kri is tishgatna. The reason why they did that is because the first word was a dirty word, and Ezra probably didn't want you to read that dirty word because people would, I don't know, giggle or get offended or walk out of shul or whatever it was. So they so it was changed. The Kri was left in, which means the Kri was what God gave you, and the Kri was just because that's what needed to be read. There are other Kri kids we don't even understand exactly why they were there. For instance, in all the story of Rivka, it always calls her Na'ara, but it's spelled Na'ar. Take a look there. And there's a ketiv on every single one that has a kamat under it, but there's no following hay. Why did it, when Hashem gave the Torah to Moshe, why did he decide to call her a Na'ar, as opposed to a Na'ara? That is, he didn't call her a Na'ar, he called her Na'ara. But why did he spell it Na'ar? I don't know, because she had a good right hook. I don't know. I don't. What? She was a Talmud. I don't. It's hard to conjecture. There, it's not such an issue because you could pronounce Na'ar or Na'ara without a problem. In the first case, it's a real change. Here, the question is, there may be an issue where there's a massive difference between the texts. Na'ar and Na'ara doesn't make a difference. Tishagel not Tishkavna doesn't make a difference. This makes a humongous difference. And we have that one davening, Velo Nitzkino Alilut. Where is that from? Velo Nitzkino Alilut. That's from somewhere in, what's that?
Somewhere in
Tehillim. And it's spelled Lamed Aleph, but its Kri is Lamed Vav. Lamed Aleph means no, and Lamed Vav means his. Now, even that's not so bad, because you could sort of make it where it means that he doesn't have these problems, which means these problems are, you know, his mastery. So you could work it out. Here, we have a big problem. Tremendous problem, because these are the question is who won the war, and why is it that I'm able to build the temple now? Is it because I finished the war, so now it's ready for me, or is it because he finished the war and left me with no war to do? I guess in the end it's not a killer. The bottom line is right now there's no war, and therefore he's able to build the temple. But I have to say, inquiring minds want to know: was Shlomo making battle, or was Shlomo? We know Shlomo had a massive army that we established when we looked at the amount of soldiers, horses he had. The question is: did he use them for actual attack? Or did he use them in according to this, possibly according to the Kri, use them for actual attack? According to the Ketiv, he never used them for actual attack. They were simply a way of controlling what David had already conquered. This
could
is one
an issue of Kibrav, that he actually finished the job. It really was by the lie, but since he was saying it to a friend of his father's,
we'll never know where the Kri Ketiv came from. The theories are many. The most uncomfortable theory I can give you is I could show you Dead Sea Scrolls, and the difference between a Vav and a Yud is so slight that in 9 times out of 10 you'd be hard-pressed to say which one it is.
It could be a typo, right?
What's that? It could be a typo. It could be that when Ezra, what may have happened is when Ezra came back from destruction, he had a Torah in his hands, and it said the word Raglav, but he was sure it was wrong. He remembered. Ezra remembered it was Raglav, but he didn't want to erase the original text because that's the text he had in front of him. So in the margins, he wrote Raglad. That is the opinion of, whose opinion? I think Elias Levita, who edited the Mikro Kedolot Bible that we had. It was a great scholar. If I'm not mistaken, I don't remember, maybe Abar Vanel, I can't remember which. There's so many opinions, and they're so complex, because you have to, different creeds have different rules that govern them. So that could be the case here, that Ezra came back and he made fixes. And of course, there's a famous story in the Gemara which says that when somebody came back, they found 3 Torahs in the Heichal. 2 were spelled like this, and 1 was spelled the other way. So they went after the majority. And then the other one, so A and B won out against C in one reading. But then A and C won out against B in another reading. And A and B won out against C in the other reading. And they always fixed based on the majority, which means the Torah that they produced was from none of those 3 original Torahs, but was a superset of all 3.
Just
a Yod and the Vav, or no, there was a significant word that was changed. Not in meaning. In one case, the word was Na'are, as opposed to Zatute. Na'are means young, or the chosen ones, and Zatute is the same word but in Aramaic. And of course, there are Aramaic words that show up in the Torah from time and again, like when Laban speaking, so he says Yigal Sahaduta. which means this is a gal is a stone, and Sahaduta is a witness. So what Ravan speaking, so he speaks in his original Aramaic. And there were other places where Aramaic is spoken in the Torah, and this was, according to some scribe, he felt that the original was Zatuta. Some other scribe probably thought the first scribe made a mistake, and he said, there's no way the word Aramaic would be there. It must be Naro. Ezra comes back, and he's got a problem. After 70 years of destruction, it's not like they had Sefer Torahs with them. So he's coming back based on his memory, putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. And the rule was, you take the majority, this is the rule, you take the majority of the quality readings, and you go after that reading.
It wasn't
I was gonna say there was no Torah that read Tirtzach Tignov, but I think yours I think yours is worse. What's that?
Did they bring any Torahs with them?
No, Bavel. No, they were on the run in Bavel. They were slaves and captives.
The Torah were originally in South Israel, as the Yidden of Bavel
presented. Well, the question is when they got switched over to Tavashuri.
By the
that was in Bavel.
Yeah, it's a good question. It may have Assyrian script already exists in the time of Ezra. There's no doubt about that. It could be that the original version that Moshe had was in South Israel. Although we actually postulate it wasn't. We postulate it was South Ashuri. That's the way we poskim. You don't remember the famous miracle? The Lukot had a miracle because the mem would fall out because it's surrounded. That only works if you have Tzav Ashuri, not Tzav Ivri. So the way we poskim officially is, you know, the rabbis aren't sure. And the way we poskim the Gemara is that it was Tzav Ashuri. But even if it wasn't Tzav Ashuri, it looked like it was acceptable to write in either language. And therefore, at some time, it had evolved into Tav Ashuri, and it may have even been by Ezra's time. There's no reason to think that Ezra didn't have Tav Ashuri. That Tav definitely existed at by about 500 BCE. You definitely had Tav Ashuri. Yeah, you definitely had that script. Phoenician was actually kind of going out of style. Sure, they had it on coins and stuff. The Maccabees did not write a Tav Ashuri. How do we know this? Because we have books in the Dead Sea Scrolls that date back to the year 250 and even almost 300 years BCE. That's only about 50 years after, 50 to 75 years after Alexander the Great. And it is Ketav Ashuri interspersed with occasional Ketav Ivri. Where do they use Ketav Ivri? When they're writing Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. They don't want to write Yud-Kei Vav-Kei in Ketav Ashuri, so they write it in Ketav Ivri. Whether that's because it's more holy, or whether it's because it's less holy, nobody knows. Nobody. It's a big machloket scholars. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. So, I'm sorry, did I cut you off, though? I apologize. So in this case, you're right, in this case, I'm just conjecturing about the Vav and the Yud. It may not be there. It could be that the original author, I want to say, it may even be that the original author wanted to read it both ways. Yeah. It may be. He wanted to see it in both ways, and therefore, since you can't, the problem with Hebrew, Tanakh, is you can't use parentheses. Okay. See footnote 3 on page 57. You can't do anything like that. Can you imagine, you know, trying to erase that and put it back together? So, what's that? Oh, that's right. So occasionally you got those parentheses, and the question is, where is that supposed to be? It's either a different book, it's in a different location, it was his own separate book. Even there, the rabbis don't know exactly. They know something's going on, but they don't know what's going on. But anytime you get to things that are parenthetical, or where the author may have wanted to say two things at once, they may have used it. We simply do not know. There are many good theories. There are many more terrible theories. And among the good theories, you could pick or choose, but the truth is, it's like nature nurture. It probably depends on the situation. Like the nikudot over the letters. Sometimes the nikudot mean one thing, and sometimes the dots, the superlinear dots, sometimes they mean one thing, and sometimes they mean the other thing. It depends on when and where they're used. The ones on Lanu Levanenu Adolam are probably not the same ones as when Esav sees his brother, Vayashik Tehu, and he kisses him. Probably means something else. And Chazal always have an interesting story. He bit him, he wanted to bite him, but he didn't, and he kissed him instead. All kinds of interesting stories, but the truth is, we don't know for sure. And it was different rules at different times. We don't know. Whatever scribe, when Moshe was writing it down, he may have had a different intention at the time when he was writing down Sefer Bereishit than when he was writing down Sefer Tevarim. They were not written at the same time. He had 40 years to put them together, and he may have used different... and he had a limited number of editing tools. He didn't have italics, didn't have bold, didn't have footnotes. He had dots and nuns. That's what he was left with. He had to express himself completely using dots and nuns. And you wind up with a little bit of confusion in the actual text. On the Targum. And those are the crowns that come up out of them. Yeah, that's another problem, which I'm not going to get into. That's a whole different can of words, because the question is when those crowns come into play. I went. I sort of I taught more about the Bible than teaching actual Bible itself. I'm sorry. We were going to get to the Treaty of Tsur. Just to give you, I want to give you just a flavor, and next time, Blin Nedder, we'll discuss the Treaty of Death. At first, the treaty is very good, and then the treaty goes very south. The treaty will go south, and guess whose fault it is that the treaty goes south? No? No? No, Tsur is fine. What? No. What drove the treaty of Hiram and Shlomo to the grave? It's always a woman. It's a creator Shiva. Creator Shiva will drive the treaty into the grave, and I'll show you how that works. And it's classic politics. She wanted instead of wanting a north access, she wanted to gain control over the gold trade. And I'll show you how that works. But just to give you a sense of where Tsur is, it's very interesting. She gives him X amount of gold, and the next pasuk, Hiram's trying to make up the same amount of gold as well. Once he's only given wood, but all of a sudden he's got to compete with you got to keep up with the Joneses, and you're giving all of a sudden you're giving gold. And in the exact same number, by the way. Just to give you a picture where Tsur is and we'll end, this is what Tsur looks like today. Tsur is on the Phoenician coast.
Lebanon.
It's Lebanon, about, maybe 10, 15 kilometers south of modern-day Beirut. Modern-day Beirut, which was called Gabal, I believe, at the time. It wasn't called Beirut, but it was a known city, not a major city. This was the major city for a very good reason. Do you see? It sticks out into the ocean. Today, it sticks out into the ocean. 2,000 years ago, it did not stick out in the ocean. It was part of the ocean. It was an island city. It was disconnected from the land. It was unconquerable. They built walls around all the edges. It had the main city, and then it had another city called Mushur, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm not sure about the name, which was the one that was on the land that supplied them with goods. And you read stuff like Egypt. I conquered everything except for the city of Tsur, but him I locked up in a cage for X amount of years. But it was like an unsiegeable city. You couldn't storm it. It essentially had no land group whatsoever. So about 2,000 years ago, they realized that was a problem. Obviously, probably the Romans did not like the idea that they've got this powerful city. So they created this land bridge that went to it. But it ruled, this was the capital city of Sidon, of Sidon, which ruled over a greater part of Lebanon that Israel itself didn't rule over. So essentially what you're doing is you're creating a greater Lebanon-Israel. And that's really what's being done, which as far as I could say, I've gone over time, but apparently God's very happy about it, to be honest. There's nothing inherent, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with this treaty. It seems to be a satisfactory treaty. I don't think God, I'm not speaking for God, Chashom, or even for the prophet, but when they talk about Hiram, the young Jewish boy that helps build the Beit HaMikdash, who's somehow from Tsur, there's no sense of negative about that. He comes and he builds the Beit HaMikdash. He's the new Bezalel. The sense is that what's going on is that Judaism is spreading slowly but surely through the world, positively so, and that it'll eventually take over Phoenicia as well. If Phoenicia is sending its boys down to build the Beit HaMikdash, and its trees to build the Beit HaMikdash, then voila, that's a nice thing, I suppose. It's impossible to tell for sure, but one does not sense any negativeness in this treaty until it starts to go south, and then the negativeness is really on Shlomo's decisions about the treaty and not about the treaty itself, and we'll see that treaty next time. The question is which sea? So the Sidonites, the sewer, Tyre of today, controlled the Mediterranean partially. There were also Aegeans. The Phoenicians originally sort of came, part of them were, the Plishtim came, not only the Plishtim, but they
Crete
in that area. But not the Phoenicians themselves were a mix of people, the Semites that were there and the mix of the Aegeans that came down. But there was another sea route that's very important, which we're going to see later, which is the Gulf of Aqaba going down into... The rich part of the world was not the Aegeans. Europe was a big bunch of barbarians. The gold came out of Africa, and therefore whoever controlled the Suez Canal going down to the Red Sea, essentially if you travel down that sea, you got African coast on your right, and Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula on your left, and then if you keep traveling, you have the Hodu as well. That was the major thoroughfare. And the city which controls that is Eilat. So eventually that will be part of the treaty. Etzion Gaver. Yeah, the truth is, our Eilat today was not originally Eilat. The original Eilat that we know of was, what's the Jordanian city right next to Eilat?
Aqaba.
That's what, when the Torah speaks of Eilat, it actually means modern-day Aqaba. When it speaks of Etzion Gaver, it's speaking of our Eilat. But the truth is, the two are
I thought it was a little further south on the African coast.
They're very close to each other. I think you could see one from the other on even on such a bright day. I'm pretty sure.
They're
What's that? They're connected, aren't they? Oh, but they're close to each other, right? Yeah, I think Aqaba is very close to Etzion Gaza. They were two separate cities, and why the names got switched around, I don't know. But and these would be a very critical city. We'll see that Shlomo and Hiram set up shop there. So we'll do the treaty, God willing, next. Have a good night.